Hey, it's your co-host Paul here with a quick word before we start the show. On this episode, some of our guests will discuss religious trauma, suicide, and suicide statistics. Please take care of yourselves. You are loved. You are welcome here.
My name's Mark Baer. I was born and raised here in coastal South Carolina. Retired critical care nurse. Married gay dad of three amazing sons.
Mark, I wanted to have you on in part because of something you wrote for the Free Times in Columbia several months ago. It was about your experience with conversion therapy. I was wondering if you could start by just reading the beginning of that, just the first four paragraphs.
Growing up in South Carolina in the 1970s, I knew two things about myself. I was gay, and I was going to be a dad someday. But in the world around me, those two truths did not fit in the same box. Back then, being gay was something you were expected to hide, to fix, or to pray away. Being a father was a dream I clung to, but it felt like one that required me to erase the other parts of myself. So I tried. I married my high school sweetheart. We had a beautiful child together. From the outside, I was doing what was expected, what was normal. But inside, I was unraveling. The conflict between who I was and who I was pretending to be nearly killed me. I voluntarily entered conversion therapy. I was so desperate to change. What I experienced was a toxic mix of relentless shame, spiritual manipulation, and two horrifying rounds of electroshock therapy. The internalized homophobia ran so deep that I told my family that I went into rehab for cocaine addiction, because at that time, that felt less shameful than admitting I was trying not to be gay.
Mark, for people who've never been through conversion therapy or never known someone who did it, what do you want them to know about it?
How damaging it is. What I really want people to understand about conversion therapy is the damage it creates, not only in the current, but the lasting effects. I went through this voluntarily in my early 20s, and I'm in my 50s now and still learning the ways that I'm still trying to heal.
For you, you wrote that there was a religious element to this that was part of the reason you sought it out. I think that's pretty common from my understanding of a lot of folks who enter this form of so-called therapy. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was the religious impulse for you?
I really think that the impetus for even the catalyst for me starting to look for conversion therapy was the exposure to the religious elements. Growing up, my parents needed to care for my younger brother who was sick and later diagnosed with leukemia. So that meant a lot of times that I grew up staying with people that would offer their homes. That was usually from within the faith community. During the 70s and 80s, there was very conservative, very ugly views of being gay, being homosexual. I remember hearing as a child growing up that HIV and AIDS was God's retribution for being gay or being queer, and the damnation of hellfires. When you're growing up with that, and you're not, that's the only representation you're seeing of what gay means, that leaves lasting scars with you. So growing up, I knew I still needed to be this dad. That was a huge part of me, but I could not wrap my head around this religious side of things. So that's what led me. I started the pray away the gay. I mean, being a young child at night, asking God to fix me. Growing up thinking I was wrong, I was broken, that something needed to change. And the church was reinforcing that. Society reinforced what the church was saying. So what else did I have to believe in?
Welcome to episode 14 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
I'm your other host, Paul Bowers.
Today's episode is all about an anti-LGBTQ practice that is sometimes called conversion therapy. And we just heard from someone who went through conversion therapy as an adult. And we've heard from so many therapists, doctors, and survivors of these practices this year. We know it is a far cry from therapy. So let's talk about some definitions here. Paul, what is conversion therapy?
Yeah, I've had to learn a lot this year. But the big picture is conversion therapy is a medically discredited practice that seeks to change a person's sexual orientation or their gender identity through counseling, religious interventions, or other methods. There are people who've been through it and swear it worked. There are people who've been through it and describe it as a form of torture. But looking at the evidence, looking at the decades of studies that have been done on how and if it works, we know that there is no mainstream medical or psychiatric organization in the United States that supports what we call conversion therapy. The evidence shows that none of these interventions work to change someone's orientation or gender identity, and that in so many cases, this practice really harms people.
And if you're wondering why we're talking about this now, it's because very recently a political debate played out when state lawmakers essentially demanded, extorted the city of Columbia, forcing them into repealing a ban on conversion therapy that the city council had put in place a number of years ago. We're going to get into the details of that later, but that's why now.
Yeah, I also want to mention that conversion therapy is in the national spotlight right now because of a U.S. Supreme Court case out of Colorado. That one's called Childs v. Salazar. And in that case, there's an anti-LGBTQ legal organization called the Alliance Defending Freedom. They are suing to overturn Colorado's ban on conversion therapy. So that case is scheduled for oral arguments at some point during this Supreme Court term, which is 2025 to 26. So you may be hearing more and more about this concept in the next few months. But because Jace and I, we are provincial South Carolina guys, we are going to talk a little bit about the history of this practice, including some very recent history right here in South Carolina. South Carolina has kind of a unique place in the history of this practice. It became sort of a hub for it in the 2010s. And so I wanted to get into that. And to do this, I'm going to rely a lot on some reporting from a few reporters in South Carolina. So I'm a former newspaper reporter. And when I was in the news business, there was a really stunning series of articles that came out in the Post and Courier. This was around 2018 through 2020. They were written by a couple of colleagues of mine back then, Mike Makrovich and M.K. Wildeman. And they looked into the history of conversion therapy and why it remains so prevalent in South Carolina, even after it was falling out of favor all around the country and the world. So I'll put a link to this in the show notes if you want to read it. Fair warning, it is a heavy read. It's really gutting and includes a lot of really heavy stories. But the headline of the main piece they wrote was called "Taught to Hate Myself: How Gay Conversion Therapy in South Carolina is Thriving." So the two of them, they spent 7 months researching various things that went by the names of conversion therapy, reparative therapy, and ex-gay ministries. And they found that there were, as of 2018, at least 22 of these ministries, organizations, and practitioners around the Southeast. And at the time, at least 9 of those groups were operating in South Carolina.
And Paul, one of the things that this brings up for me is like, I don't think we're talking about like little mom and pop, counselors. My sense is that we're talking about some larger institutions that operate in multiple states. And this is a money-making venture, right, for them. Is that right? Am I thinking about that correctly?
Yeah, there's a real mix. I mean, sometimes it is a really small sort of operation. But yeah, especially in the case of South Carolina, there were organizations based here that were operating all over the country, and we were sort of the hub for their operations. So, quoting from the piece, "Conversion therapy today can be found in many forms. It takes place in quiet conversations with spiritual leaders, in support groups of people hoping to move past same-sex attractions, and in sessions with religious therapists. One man described group sessions in a Columbia church basement, followed by one-on-one time in a counselor's office, where he was compelled to watch heterosexual pornography in an effort to cultivate a desire for women." Now, a psychotherapist that they interviewed for this story said that conversion therapists often reinforce a client's worst feelings about themselves, and that can result in depression or much worse. And these ministries tended to focus on sexual attraction. You know, they were commonly called ex-gay ministries, but they also sometimes addressed and do address gender identity. One ministry at the time had a book out that was called "When Your Child Breaks Your Heart, Coping with Gay and Transgender Kids."
You know, I think it's important to note that when we talk about these falling out of favor, you know, it's not just because, you know, LGBTQ folks have been bravely coming out and sharing their stories. And as people got to know LGBTQ folks, they realized that trying to change people was misguided and harmful, right? Obviously, that was happening. But also, part of the reason that this is discredited is because all these people who created it came out and said, this doesn't work. It's never worked. I've never seen it work. And it's just important to note, like, this seemed to fall apart under its own weight of lies.
Yeah. That at the time this piece came out, conversion therapy was really on the outs. A lot of states were banning it, and some cities and counties were banning it. We know today 23 states have banned conversion therapy in one form or another, but South Carolina bucked the trend in certain ways. And yeah, you're right. It was in a lot of places, it wasn't even legislation that changed the state of things. It was that the ministries themselves collapsed. Founders were coming out of the woodwork to say, we've been trying to do this for decades and it doesn't work and we're hurting people. So back then, this was again, you know, late 2010s, and these organizations were in sort of a crisis mode. One of the most prominent ones was called Exodus International, and they were founded in Florida in the 1970s, but they were operating all over the country. And one really pivotal moment in the history of this was that the founder of that group, a man named Michael Bussey, he denounced the whole organization. And he wrote that he had never met a gay person who became heterosexual through conversion therapy or ex-gay programs. So he left. And then in 2013, the longtime president of Exodus, a man named Alan Chambers, publicly quit at a conference of the organization itself. He gave this speech where he apologized for the harm and the guilt that he had put on people. And that ministry collapsing really set up a domino effect where other ministries, many of which were directly inspired by Exodus, also just started having these crises of belief and management, and a lot of them closed forever.
I remember in 2013, I remember this happening. I had just come out as transgender. I was, you know, kind of early days of my transition. And I really thought what happened at Exodus was going to completely end this pseudoscientific practice, right? This selling snake oil. And that's why it was so surprising to me when South Carolina lawmakers are, you know, come and attack this. I mean, it's been, you know, over a decade that the sort of forefathers of ex-gay ministry of conversion therapy came out and admitted this is not working. And I felt like, you know, blast from the past when our state decided that they wanted to take down the one city that had a ban on conversion therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. As these ministries were closing up shop in other states, They really put down roots here in South Carolina. So at the time that Exodus closed down, there was another group in Spartanburg, South Carolina called Hope for Wellness that originally started in the late 90s as a sister ministry to Exodus. And then it sort of took over after Exodus fell as a leading organization doing this type of work and offering this type of so-called therapy. And so they were based in Spartanburg, but they operated in 15 states. And then in 2017, sort of as the dominoes were falling elsewhere, the founder of this Spartanburg-based ministry was a man named McCray Game, and he resigned. And he told the newspaper at the time, "I strongly encourage anyone taking that journey to learn to accept and love themselves. I believe God loves us regardless of our attractions or relationships." So, you know, the hub for these types of, you know, activities, these types of ministries was in South Carolina, but even here, they were starting to really crumble. So, after that, you know, a few years after this big piece ran in the Post and Courier, Mike Grovich wrote a follow-up piece because Hope for Wellness closed its doors for good in 2020. As of 2020, it felt like that phase was coming to an end. So it's against that backdrop that our state's leading politicians, 5 years later, have decided to take up this fight again for some reason over conversion therapy. People forget this, but Henry McMaster, our governor, said during his most recent reelection campaign in 2022 that effectively he would ban gay marriage again in South Carolina if he could. He was waiting for an overturn of Obergefell and said that if that happens, then South Carolina's constitution would forbid same-sex marriage again. And, you know, I think those of us who remember that victory, who are old enough to remember the time before, recognize that progress is just so fragile here.
Yeah, well said. And really on that note, let's get into what happened in Columbia, why we're talking about conversion therapy, what brought this home again. So in this segment, we have our very own Matthew Butler. He's an advocacy strategist, and Andy Reeder from the Harriet Hancock LGBT Center in Columbia. Let's give it a listen.
My name's Andy Reeder, she, her. I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Harriet Hancock Center.
My name is Matthew Butler, and I use he, him pronouns, and am an advocacy strategist with the ACLU of South Carolina.
So let's go back to 2021. That was when Columbia City Council passed a ban on conversion therapy by licensed professionals on minors in the city of Columbia. That was the first conversion therapy ban in South Carolina. So far, still the only one. But back in 2021, why was this an important issue, and why did LGBTQ rights organizations see that as a priority?
Well, in the 2010s, we saw a lot of jurisdictions, states, cities, other municipalities across the country really moving forward with this. We emulated some of these other communities, and Columbia took a stand to make a statement of support for the LGBTQ community. It's also important to note that along with passing this particular ordinance, the city also passed a resolution calling on the state to outlaw conversion therapy across the board as well.
Do we know anything about the effects of that policy? Like, has the city ever had to enforce it since then? What do we know?
So as far as we know, and the city council also made this quite clear during the city meetings, they have had zero reports of conversion therapy happening within the city. That doesn't mean, though, that it wasn't important. And there's a million reasons for why it could be zero and why this ordinance hasn't been enforced. We touched on those at the city council meetings themselves. It could have been the reporting mechanism wasn't there. It could be people don't know that something bad is happening to them or that they are being subjected to conversion therapy. They think that they might need it, or it's being told that it's something different. there's a bunch of reasons why the number is zero.
And I just, you know, and it's probably that, but also, you know, as a preventative or symbolic isn't the right word, but as a piece of legislation, you know, I would suggest something like this. We aren't repealing fire codes because there haven't been fires. So, you know, it's, while there could be concerns about there not being any reporting incidents, it could very well be that, you know, the regime works in the sense that professional mental health professionals who are licensed are not, in fact, violating the ordinance. But as Andy said, there may have been other factors in play along those reporting guidelines.
So, you know, 2021, Columbia passes this ordinance. About 4 years pass, and in 2025, City Council rescinds the ordinance. What changed? I mean, what outside pressures led City Council to reconsider and then abandon this policy they passed 4 years ago?
So, it's really interesting. You know, the Supreme Court earlier in this particular decade declined to hear appeals of the Washington State conversion therapy ban, so leaving it in place. The same two characters prominently involved this go-round, Senator Josh Kimbrell and Attorney General Alan Wilson, were the same two characters that were pushing in 2021 for the city not to do this, threatening lawsuits. At that time, Senator Kimbrell introducing legislation that did not advance that would have punished the city of Columbia.
These, by the way, are not Columbia officials, right? We're talking about a state senator from the upstate and the state attorney general. So I'll go over the state budget part of this attack. It was Senator Josh Kimbrell of Spartanburg County who slipped some language into the state budget, very obviously targeting Columbia for its ordinance restricting conversion therapy. And he did this by introducing a proviso, which is a one-year law that gets tacked onto the state budget, restricting the use of state funds. So specifically, he added Proviso 113.10, which says, if a municipality receives funds from the local government fund and by ordinance prohibits medical and mental health professionals from providing conversion therapy or reparative therapy to minors at any time during the current fiscal year, then the treasurer must claw back all such funds of the municipality to the local government fund. And lest there be any confusion about the ideological basis of this budget proviso, it ends with this sentence: nothing in this proviso prohibits a medical or mental health professional from offering assistance to a minor struggling with gender identity, so long as the assistance does not encourage gender transition. Well, Andy, maybe you could help with this part. I know you and Matt and a lot of other people around Columbia spent a lot of time in City Hall this year, probably more time than you had planned on spending there. But walk me through some of the sort of saga of City Council meetings this spring. I mean, how many times in all did they meet about this? And what was going on in those meetings?
So overall, we attended 6 meetings, and only 4 of those 6 had actual formal conversion therapy ordinance on the agenda. So it all started April 22nd is when Attorney General Alan Wilson demanded in a letter that the Columbia City Council repeal Ordinance 2021-021, also known as the conversion therapy ban. So we actually mobilized some of our community partners, such as the ACLU and some other queer organizations in the area. And on May 1st, as a group, we urged the community to sign on to a letter urging the Columbia City Council to reject A.G. Wilson's demands. So between May 1st and May 6th, we had about 400 signatures from those who live in Columbia and also those who work and play in Columbia. And we presented those signatures, that letter, and some statistics to the City Council at that first meeting on May 6th. We once again mobilized the community. People showed up at all of these meetings we attended over the past 2 months. The council chambers were so full, it was standing room only.
Good afternoon. My name is Dylan Gunnels. I serve as president of South Carolina Pride, as well as the founder of the Agape Table. This book lives in the closet, literally. This was my homework at 15 and 16 years old when I went through conversion therapy. Imagine the hope that I had for a book that said, you don't have to be gay. Because being gay meant that I was ostracized from my family. I was ostracized from my friends and my opportunities. I was ostracized from the only work I ever knew and felt called to, which was the church. I was also told that it meant I would go to hell. And so imagine the hope that we feel when we are encountered with these false premises of therapy that are going to fix us and make us better and heal us and say, you don't have to be that way. But it was all a lie. And today I stand before you telling you that that therapy did nothing for me. All it did was harm me.
But as I noted, my name is Dr. Isabel Mandel, long-term member of the licensing board for the state of South Carolina for psychologists. And in my belief, a ban on conversion therapy in this city protects the public, and most particularly children. If an adult would like to do that, that is an adult purview. But a part of the responsibility of the government is to protect children from harm. And this is a harmful practice. I will not call it therapy because it is not therapy. The goal of therapy is to help and support and provide encouragement and growth. And what this does provides none of that. It provides harm.
Okay, this next name might ring a bell. This is McCrae Game, the founder of Hope for Wholeness, the ex-gay organization up in Spartanburg.
Thank you, Council. I'm McCrae Game. I'm from Spartanburg, South Carolina. Today, I'm 56 years old. I've been out now for 5 years, but I took a little 30-year jaunt into conversion therapy as ended up in 8 years of conversion therapy as a client, and drank the Kool-Aid so much, I started my own organization that was Truth Ministry, then ended up being Hope for Wholeness, one of the largest, we'll call ex-gay ministries in the world. But one thing I never did with my clients is I never promised them that their attractions were going to change, because mine never had. I worked with a number of teenagers, a lot of parents pressuring their teenagers. And fortunately, I was not of the type that was really on the parent's side, even though people hated me and thought that's what I was doing. I was more really advocating for the teenager. Conversion therapy, or whatever you want to call it, is harmful for anyone. I was able to allow all the angst about my sexuality to go to rest once I accepted it. And I would encourage you to not consider repealing this ban.
Thank you for being here.
So on May 20th, we attended that first meeting. The vote was deferred. On May 23rd, the City Council called a special called meeting where the sole item was the repeal of the conversion therapy ordinance. That meeting occurred on May 27th. During that meeting, the council went into an executive session for a little over an hour, right at the beginning of the meeting. And when they returned, Mayor Wickerman addressed the community in what I can only describe as a condescending manner about our involvement, about some of the news cycle that was happening around this process, and essentially blaming the community for not taking this ordinance further back in 2021. Once again, we had an hour of public testimony, dozens of community members testifying to the City Council, and the City Manager also informed the community and the City Council of the budgetary concerns, what might happen if they do lose that money that was outlined in the budget proviso at the state level. And then once again, this City Council voted to defer the vote. At that point, we weren't 100% sure what was going to happen with the ordinance. It sounded like it might have been wrapped up from her testimony, the mayor agreeing. Then on June 13th, the Columbia City Council placed repealing Ordinance 2021-021 on the agenda once again. That meeting occurred on June 17th. Once again, dozens of community members testified. We were there for hours. They brought the ordinance to a vote. Councilwoman Tina Herbert delivered some remarks reflecting on the weeks leading up to this vote and what she had learned. She mentioned the Human Rights Campaign's Equality Index and how this would inform people of where they might choose to live and where Columbia landed on this index. And she also even likened it to the Green Book. Interestingly enough, Will Brennan also mentioned this Human Rights Campaign Equality Index and stated that having this conversion therapy ordinance on the books only gained them 2 points on this index. He was very interested in the points and how the city could gain points in perhaps a more efficient manner, having a coalition or a police presence with LGBTQ.
That's such a wild response to it, just to fixate on, you know, points in some index. That's really kind of missing the forest for the trees there, right?
Yes, and then ultimately he voted to repeal the ordinance, ending the vote with 4 yeas and 3 nays. Obviously a complete turn from his vote in 2021, where he was a key member in getting the ordinance passed in the first place.
Oof. Thank you for being there through all of that. I think a lot of people around the state were paying attention because this matters directly for people in Columbia, but it's also in some ways a really symbolic look at where things are headed statewide. And in the end, city council ultimately caved to pressure. They give in, they rescinded the ordinance. What kind of a message does that send to the LGBTQ community in Columbia?
I would say this sends the message that this decision was made irregardless of the pleas of the community. As somebody who sat in the room and listened to dozens of people testify over those 6 meetings, this tells the community that you may be able to speak, but you won't be heard. Community members and organizations presented every statistic, every fact. There were people that gave their personal stories with their experiences of conversion therapy, or maybe not even conversion therapy, but family members who had pressured them into trying to give up being queer or trans. And this didn't matter in the end. That's the message that it sends to the community, this decision. This decision also wasn't just about LGBTQ youth or reparative therapy, conversion therapy. By caving to these demands of the AG and the state legislature, the city council allowed a home rule violation, something that many community members urged the city council to consider, that they gave the power to change legislation in our community to people that don't govern our community, don't live in our community, and don't have any personal stakehold in this community.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is, I know you're both South Carolinians, you've lived through a lot here, and you know, reflecting on your experiences in South Carolina, you know, do you think things have improved on the one hand for LGBTQ people in our state? And do you worry that we're backsliding? You know, that when we see decisions like this in Columbia, are we backsliding as a state and as a country right now?
I was born in South Carolina. I've lived here my whole life, and I don't really have any intention to leave the state anytime soon. And I do recognize that my life would probably have a higher quality if I lived somewhere else. And personally, I absolutely believe that we are backsliding as a state and as a country as a whole, not only on LGBTQ plus issues, but anyone's rights outside of the rights of those of a straight white cis man. At the Harriet Hancock Center, we have a youth group, Youth Out Loud, around half of our participants are homeschooled or some sort of alternate school. And this is due to severe bullying. We had H 4624 removing the possibility of gender-affirming care for minors in our state. LGBTQ plus youth and adults alike are being told by lawmakers that they're less than human, less deserving of the rights of everybody else. And the offenses go on and on and on. But in spite of this, we will be here fighting and working to create safe spaces for LGBTQ people of all ages. And despite this decision, this disappointing decision from the Columbia City Council, we are going to continue to push for more protections and a positive change here in South Carolina and try to prevent and reverse some of this backsliding.
I should have mentioned this earlier, but yeah, if people want to get involved or they just want to give to support the Harriet Hancock Center, where should they go to find out more about that?
You can go to our website, harriethancockcenter.org. We also have an Instagram, which is just the Harriet Hancock Center is the tag, and a Facebook where we post all of our upcoming programs and events. All of our events are free except for our yearly Legacy Gala, and we provide peer support and social programming throughout the whole year for LGBTQ plus people of all ages.
To wrap things up, let's return to my interview with Mark Bayer, who spoke at the top of the show about his experience with conversion therapy. We'll be right back.
Well, Paul, I've got to tell you, kind of going through this experience, writing the article a couple of months ago and prepping for the interview today, I didn't realize how much this still impacted my life. When you have those religious implications telling you that you're meant to be damned for just who you are, when you have society confirming the same things, it leaves these scars that no wonder I've struggled with self-worth. I've struggled with wanting to be accepted, never feeling good enough. And this is 40, 50 years later. So I used to like to say that I survived conversion therapy, but I guess I'm still surviving it.
So you don't live in Columbia, but I know you were following some of the news out of Columbia as the city throughout the spring was considering rescinding its ban on conversion therapy by licensed therapists for minors. To you, I mean, as someone who went through this as an adult, what was it like watching that from afar, kind of watching this debate play out in public?
Well, I shared with you, Paul, that I'm a retired critical care nurse and I'm a dad. So when I started seeing the attacks on the ban on conversion therapy that were starting in Columbia, I found it very disturbing. That was what was kind of my catalyst for sharing this story. I haven't talked about this to people in quite a few years just because of the pain it brings up, but I need other people out there. I need the public to understand what happens to, I couldn't imagine being a youth and going through this. It was hard enough as an adult and what it does to you and the scars that it leaves you with and the shame that it's tried to instill for you to be something that you're really not. I'm, as a nurse and as a native-born South Carolinian, I'm ashamed that our state's capital is pulling stunts like this. It's shameful. I took an oath to do no harm. This does harm to real South Carolina families.
If you could talk to your younger self, you know, when you were, say, in high school, and tell younger Mark what older Mark knows now, what would you say?
If I could go back and talk to myself back in high school, I'd have to say, hang in there. Keep hanging on. It's worth it when you get to the other side. But I also have to say that the adversities that I've been through, the struggles I've been through, they shaped me and made me the man I am today.
Was there a breakthrough moment or a specific time when you remember realizing that you didn't need to feel that shame?
I experienced a pivotal moment when I went in for my third round of electroshock therapy. I went in, again, this was something I sought out. It was not something I was forced to do. I was over 18. It was something I thought I needed to do, but as they were prepping me for that third treatment, I could not go through with it. Something snapped in me. And luckily there was a nurse in that room that was my advocate, and that third session did not happen. That led me to a phone call to PFLAG. It was a phone number where it was just somebody that told me that I was not broken. I had every right to be valid and exist for who I was and how I felt and how I loved. And that helped me get through the next about 2 months that I lived in a homeless shelter. After leaving the conversion therapy and my family thinking I was away for cocaine addiction, and then coming clean and saying I was actually trying not to be gay and it's not going to work that way, that was my pivotal coming out moment, where I needed to be who I was and love who I was, because I couldn't keep living with that amount of shame that was put on me.
You mentioned a call to PFLAG. For people who are not familiar, that's PFLAG. Tell me a little bit about that. And I understand that's a big part of your life now. So tell us about PFLAG.
PFLAG is a huge part of my life. That one phone call truly saved my life. PFLAG is the nation's oldest and largest organization dedicated to the support, education, and advocacy of the queer community. Simply put, it has evolved over time, which is phenomenal to see. But it was PFLAG's philosophy is to support the LGBTQ plus community by supporting us and those that love and support us. So it brings everybody together. So when I needed to make that phone call, there was a book back in the day called The Dameron, and it was like a safety net. And that's where I found the phone number for PFLAG. And it was a gentleman a few years older than me, a straight ally, that just agreed to talk to me for a couple hours and gave me that validity that I needed. That, you know, the Trevor Project tells us by statistics that one affirming adult reduces suicide risk by more than 40%. And that man, he saved my life just by being willing to sit down with me and tell me that I was valid for being who I am and how I felt and who I loved. So about a couple of years ago when, you know, I think my life's back on track and I'm married and have kids and I'm finally achieving the life that I never thought I could have, we learned that there were some homeless kids living in one of the homeless camps around here. And the only reason they're there is because they're queer. And we took a good look, myself and a couple other families, we took a good look at the situation and we said, you know, there's nothing wrong with these kids. It's society. Still, 50 years later, society still has this messed up view and perspective on what it's like to be LGBTQIA. It's crazy. So that was where we said we needed to do something. And We got the kids taken care of, but you needed to do something to get it, to keep other kids from getting to that point. And how do we make that difference? We support the community by bringing together the community.
That's a beautiful full circle moment in a way that, you know, as someone who struggled and then had spent some time in a homeless shelter, you're now able to help and advocate for people in a similar situation. That's really beautiful. Thank you for being there for those kids and for all the people you help.
Thank you, Paul. It's a huge opportunity that I feel very blessed to be able to do this work.
Thank you for listening to another episode of While I Breathe, the official podcast of ACLU of South Carolina.
Music used on today's episode is by Daft Hartley and A Spot on the Hill.
If you would like to find ways to support the LGBTQ community in Columbia, check out the Harriet Hancock Center at harriethancockcenter.org. That's Harriet with two R's and one T, Hancock like John Hancock.
To find a PFLAG chapter in your area, visit pflag.org/findachapter. If you'd like to find out more about our work for LGBTQ rights in South Carolina, as always, you can check out our website at aclusc.org.
Thank you again for listening, and until next time, while I breathe, I hope.